Thank you, Paul. I'm delighted to see so many people here. It's a great aim for us as a church to have strong marriages at the heart of our church family. There are no experts. I think it's helpful to say that. We're all learners, and that's very much the attitude with which I'm approaching the day. I think chairs are in pairs, and I take it that the idea is that we sit next to our wife or husband. Is that the basic theme? So if you find you're actually not doing that, then that would be helpful to move. And let me just explain what I'm doing. I'm just wanting to give a sort of overarching biblical framework before we dive into some more specific areas with the more sort of set-apart sessions. So I want to talk about the grace of marriage, and I want to talk about the grace of marriage made in paradise, the grace of marriage marred by the fall, and the grace of marriage modelled on the cross. Genesis 2. Back in the 1980s, many of the marriage service talks that I've... Thank you. Is it a bit sort of echoey where you're sitting? Yeah, it is where I am. I don't know if somebody could turn me down a bit. Maybe I'll move this. Back in the 80s, many of the marriage service talks I went to at weddings went something like this. In Genesis 2, everything was good in God's creation. In Genesis 2:18, we find the first thing that is not good. Man's aloneness is not good. God therefore made a helper like opposite, and God gave Adam a companion. Now, it sounded great at a wedding. William, God has provided Janet perfectly fashioned by him for you. Janet, God has provided William a perfect match for you. And in that scheme, though one finished the wedding service with a lovely feeling of Janet and William heading into their old age, sitting by the fire, keeping each other company, God's provision of a wife for Adam was presented as little more than a cure for loneliness. The problem is, as most of you will know, that's not actually what the text says. It was Christopher Ashe who came along and showed us the context of Genesis 2:18, which of course is Genesis 2:15. The Lord took the man, put him in the garden to work it and keep it. And therefore, in that context of delegated service, Adam's aloneness is not good. So then, not good is man's aloneness refers not to his loneliness, but to man's capacity as a gender to do the work that God has given us to do. Men, we are inadequate. We cannot cope. We need women. Of course, our gender cannot cope alone with the work that God has given us to do. We can't be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. We're not hermaphrodites. I think that's the right biological term, isn't it? Something that reproduces itself. Neither, we need to realize, can we subdue the earth and have dominion over it, nor can we work it and keep it. As a gender, we need women, and men only is not good, according to God. And so God created woman, the gender, as a helper, literally like opposite, and the footnote in the ESV I think is helpful, corresponding to. Now, the word helper, of course, does not mean my own personal staff worker, nor is it a term implying lesser being. God himself is described as a helper to man later in the Bible, and therefore helper cannot mean some sort of subservient being. At the same time, like opposite or corresponding to does not mean the same as. It's very interesting that Germaine Greer now balks at the way later feminists tried to create woman the same as man. She says it was never her intention. And in the rest of Genesis 2 and 3, we see initiative, leadership, headship, and responsibility in service given to man. So who is given the responsibility to name? Adam is, Genesis 2:20. Who is given the responsibility to leave? Adam is, Genesis 2:25. Whom does God summon as responsible after the fall? God summons Adam. What does God say to Adam in Genesis 3:17? Because you have listened to your wife. So then, helper like opposite is a term meaning leadership, responsibility. Responsibility in initiative, responsibility in service. Now, so far, we've only been talking about two genders, two equal but different beings. In chapter 2, 24 to 25, the two genders are brought together and we get on to marriage. And in this context of equal but different beings with separate roles, Genesis 2, 24 and 25, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh, and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Here then is marriage. Public, it involves a real leaving, a public leaving. This isn't just a shacking up together for a few months or a few years or a couple of decades. The man takes the initiative and is responsible to state publicly in society that he has left and is now committed to the woman. Janet and I always stress to all married couples that early on in the relationship, the man needs graciously to make it plain to parents and in-laws alike that he is now responsible for the leadership of this new relationship. And such seemingly petty details as always setting the date in advance when next you will go and see both sets of families just is a gracious way of showing that you still love, you still care, you still respect and honour parents and in-laws, but actually you, the man, are now leading the couple and taking responsibility for yourselves as a couple. It's a tiny thing. Public, permanent. That is, it is for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness, in health, till death us do part kind of relationship. It's a contractual deal that is binding on both parties to the point of death. He is to hold fast to his wife. Remember your vows that day. For me, 19 years, 4 months, and 19 days ago, I think. There's never ever to be any mention of separation or divorce in the home. It is a permanent union. Not even a consideration, not even a what if, or perhaps one day. However bad things may seem to be, you are permanently united. You have made solemn vows before God himself and before all your closest friends and family. Public, permanent, physical. This is a sexual union, the physical sexual bond being part of an unviolated bond between the couple that is exclusive, privileged territory only for them. And the brilliance of sex is that it does involve the deepest physical, emotional, even psychological bond between a couple, so cementing them together. And so, actually, the Bible insists that where physically possible, regular sex is an essential part of marriage. Actually, the physical, emotional, psychological exposure of yourself to somebody else does help to cement and glue the marriage. And usually, when a marriage is going wrong, the first area you see it in is in the sex life of the couple. I mean, sorry, you don't see it, obviously, but the first area that... You know what I'm saying. Yes, we won't go any further. And therefore, that may be something that you want to talk about later in the day as a couple. What is it in the relationship that is actually giving way to these problems here in this most intimate of areas? Here then is the grace of marriage made in paradise. Very brief sketch. A couple brought together by God, working together in his perfect garden paradise, an harmonious team. Him in headship, leadership. How can I deploy our joint resources for the service of the Lord? Obviously in discussion with the wife, working it together, but with him with responsibility in service for the leadership of the couple. Her seeking to complement at every level the strengths and weaknesses of her husband so that hand in hand the team can function for God's service, to God's glory, in God's perfect garden paradise. That is, not two individuals under one roof, each with his or her own separate agenda, meeting like ships in the night, her carving out her own protected zone of independence, and him keeping his tightly guarded sphere of operation. But a team working together, one flesh, one unit, one entity, pursuing a joint goal, ministry, the service of the Lord. Let's move on then to the grace of marriage marred by the fall. And I want to spend some time here because it is, I think, extraordinarily helpful for us to understand ourselves if we understand the fall. Those of us who have been on Sunday evenings will know that we teach that Genesis 2 and 3 operate like a giant sandwich. And so you have the ideal home of Genesis 2, 1 to 17, matched by the couple being driven out of the ideal home. You have the ideal marriage, matched by the spoiled marriage. You have the temptation, matched by the excuses. And right at the center, you have the rebellion and discovery. Why is this important? Why does it matter? Because it enables us to know ourselves. If all we had were the first sections of Genesis 2, we would fail to realize that the grace of marriage has been marred. What we're dealing with in marriage, what we as couples are dealing with, is marriage that is marred in a fallen world. And therefore, I want to pause, and actually I want to take a brief tangent before we look at marred marriage, to look at the nature of temptation. You will know that in Genesis 3, 1 to 5, Satan's temptation of Eve falls in three spheres. First, did God really say? He distorts and questions God's word, making God out to be a spoil sport. Did God really say marriage is permanent, public, physical? Did he really? Isn't he just trying to spoil your enjoyment? Surely not. And then he goes on to say, you will not surely die. Satan questions our accountability to God and God's final judgment of sin. Oh, there won't be any consequences. Go on. Explore that area that you know to be inappropriate. And then finally, Satan says, God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. I think it might just... Have we got a creche for babies, I wonder? I don't know whether... Have we got a creche, or is that... Anyway, I don't know. That might be helpful. God is... the last thing he says is, God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. In other words, God is just a sort of paranoid control freak. Religion works against enlightenment. Go on, open your eyes, grow up. It seems to me extraordinarily important that we understand the nature of the enemy's attack in this particular area of marriage and sex. So there are bound to be a number here who are struggling with sexual temptation, others for whom the initial glow of marital bliss is not quite as warm and fuzzy as it once was, and possibly even some for whom marriage has turned out in their deepest thoughts to be something of a disappointment. God means what he says. Marriage is permanent, physical, public. Judgment is real. Actions have real consequences. God has spoken. His word is for our good. Step outside of the marriage bond and explore those forbidden areas, and you will find not enlightenment but enslavement. Interestingly, when it comes to the area of sin and discovery in verses 8 to 13, we find Adam and Eve hiding, making excuses, lying, and passing the buck. And my experience when dealing with lots of cases of marital unfaithfulness or breakdown is that deceit, destruction, and blame are the great common hallmarks that are present in every single case I've ever dealt with. It's the wicked in Psalm 94 who say, God does not see, God does not know. And that's exactly what you find in marital unfaithfulness. No one will discover. No one will find out. God can't see. God won't judge. Let me say, every 5 to 10 years, you will come across someone to whom you might as easily have been married. Every 5 to 10 years, you will probably come across somebody else to whom you might, in other circumstances, just as easily have been married. The temptation will be to flirt, to allow yourself to grow too close, to enjoy an inappropriate intimacy. It will be there. And at a time like that, we need to know Satan's tactics. God does see, God does know, God has spoken, God will judge. There are real consequences. Enslavement, not enlightenment, is what flows out of rebelling against God. I was at a most useful day on Thursday on sexuality and the gay agenda, and in a brilliant 15-minute presentation, Professor John Noland had this to say. Self-indulgent sexual imaginings are already a violation of the exclusivity of the marriage commitment, a breaking of faith with one's spouse. I say that again. Self-indulgent sexual imaginings are already a violation of the exclusivity of the marriage covenant, a breaking of faith with one's spouse. And as we look at this area of marriage marred by the fall, it seems to me that it may just be that there are some who've got into really bad habits and bad patterns, watching things we shouldn't, meeting people we needn't, going to places we mustn't, enjoying intimacies we oughtn't. Satan will say, did God really say? You will not surely die. God knows. You just want to be like God. And you will say, I can keep this hidden. It's not really my fault. You've no idea what he's like or she's like. You just don't understand how hard it is. And you will make numerous excuses for yourself, just as Adam and Eve did in the garden. Don't be fooled. Personally, I keep very tight rules for myself. I don't allow myself to meet with people of the opposite sex ever alone, unless it's, I say alone, unless it's public, that doesn't make sense. You know what I mean. And I make sure that it's visible and public when I'm meeting personally with somebody of the opposite sex. I don't allow myself access to any internet site I wouldn't be happy to be watching with my wife. I had to give up going to the gym, well, for all sorts of reasons. But basically, you know, MTV is soft pornography. And it was so, you know, useless going to the gym. They showed you all this sort of stuff, so I packed it in. And on trips abroad, I'm quadruply cautious. And personally, now, having talked to so many people, I'm never shocked and always anticipate that the worst is going on, which is why I'm talking like this now about temptation in a world marred by the fall. In fact, I shocked one young church leader the other day who said to me that there was a really big problem with the internet porn amongst his young men. And I responded straight away by saying to him, do you find that's a problem for you personally? And his jaw nearly hit the floor. He didn't, thankfully, which was a great blessing. But the big lesson for us of Genesis 3 is that marriage is now marred. And so having dealt with that slight tangent on temptation and knowing the enemy and realizing where the assault is going to come from and what I'm going to say when the assault comes, I mean, it's pathetic, isn't it, when men turn and say, well, you know, as they're caught in sin, well, actually, it's not really my fault. It's pathetic. But anyway, that may be you, and you may need some help today on that. Let's look at marriage and Genesis 3:16. Because Genesis 3 tells us not only will we be tempted, but actually as part of the fall, marriage itself will be marred. I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. So then the whole business of childbirth, and I think raising children, is marred. You shall raise children with difficulty. Your pain in childbearing, I think it's more than just the giving birth. I think it involves the whole raising of children. And what should be a perfect relationship in the home has potential to become a war zone. And then verse 16b, your desire shall be for your husband, could be you will find yourself drawn irresistibly to your husband, even though at times he's a beast, and often I've seen that to be the case, women drawn irresistibly and inexorably to men who treat them appallingly. But it could also be that your desire will be against your husband, that is, you'll want to resist your husband and his authority. You will not like want to be a helper like opposite. So God set up this perfect situation where you've got him in leadership, her as helper like opposite. But part of the judgment of the fall is that you will not want to be a helper like opposite. You'll want to carve out your own independent path over against his leadership. You will want to be anarchic. And it may just be that for some women here, you make it very, very hard for your husband to exercise his God-given responsibility. That will be your temptation in marriage marred by the fall. Notice too that the man is included in verse 16. He will rule over you. The word rule over suggests an overbearing presence instead of gracious, kind, gentle, encouraging, nurturing leadership. A demeaning, selfish, exploitative, manipulative leadership that puts down and cuts and is destructive. Here then is the grace of marriage marred by the fall. I will be tempted to abuse my position. Janet will be tempted to subvert my authority and set up her own sphere of independence. I will be tempted to manipulate, to put down, to make unreasonable demands, to have Janet serve me to my selfish ends, to belittle her such that she loses confidence. I will want to rule over her. I will be tempted, like Adam, to abrogate my responsibility, to be lazy and not to take the lead, to get home and retreat from the tough zone of childcare, to let her take over and not put any energy into planning the home, to use all my creative energy into planning my work, but actually to spend no time in nurturing and leading at home. That's part of a fallen world, and that's the temptation we're to be battling against. Our wedding service talk was an excellent talk. Christopher Ashe would have been very positive about it. And he spent quite a bit of the sermon talking about Janet's qualities. You can imagine it took most of the time. And he then said, under the leadership and gentle nourishing of William, we should expect Janet to blossom and flower. We ought to be able to say of her, why, on September the 8th, 1990, I knew Janet. She was fun, servant-hearted, selfless. But now, look at the way that has flourished. Now, you may say to me, this has all been phenomenally negative. Don't forget, the first part of the talk, Grace of Marriage in Paradise, was actually quite positive. You may say everything else has been negative. Yes, it has been negative. It was positive at the beginning. I just wanted to look at the fall, because it enables realism about marriage, and it's important that we know ourselves, and it actually diagnoses for us the areas in which men and women are going to be separately tempted in marriage to contribute to a less happy marriage. Realism. I think it's really important to be realistic about marriage in a fallen world. There is no such thing as the ideal wife or the ideal husband. I think it just is important to be clear on that. And I'm frightened that sometimes Christians buy into the lie of the world and that think that one day we will stumble across Leonardo DiCaprio, who is also Christian. We meet him, we found him, we marry him, and then sometime down the track we discover actually that he's flawed. It may take 10 years. And then we begin, and then the blokes, you know, we think one day we will woo Naomi Campbell, who is also a Christian. And we meet her, woo her, marry her, and then discover. And then, of course, if we're not realistic, disappointment, dissatisfaction, and discontent can creep in. And we wonder, you know, might there be some better plan or better way? No, there's no such thing as the perfect wife or the perfect husband. Mark Ashton said to Janet and I very early on, before we were married, two sinners under one roof will only result in one thing, conflict. Marriage, William, is about holiness, not happiness. Which, I mean, that was quite a bleak view, wasn't it? But it was a helpful thought, and to be clear that, you know, not to be sort of so idealistic about marriage. Now, you're two sinners, one tempted to subvert the leadership of the other. The other tempted to dominate and exploit. And it enables me to know myself. It alerts me to where my dangers are going to be. I'm going to want to domineer my wife, exploit her selfishly. Janet is likely to want to strike out on her own, subverting my leadership. And men, we need then to know both where we will find things hard and where our wives will find things hard, and wives equally. I just want to say something about the bedroom at this stage, because I think some of the celebrity preachers in the States are saying one or two very unhelpful things in this area. Men, it is just as easy to be selfish in the bedroom as it is in any other area. Your wife is not there simply to fulfill your most wild, pagan, sexual fantasy. I think there is such a thing as inappropriate sex. And some of the preachers in the States seem to suggest that anything goes. Wives, in the bedroom, it is equally easy to subvert your husband's leadership and to manipulate. Now, I think you'll know what I mean, if you don't, then work it out with another girl. Talk it through with another girl. That'd be good. The grace of marriage modeled on the cross in the last few minutes. As we come through the New Testament, to Ephesians 5, we find that with God's help, we are to see the fallen relationships of Genesis 3 restored and rightly ordered under the kingly rule of Jesus through the grace of the cross. Ephesians 5:21-33. We find here that the purpose of marriage has always been to model to the world the key relationship for which every one of us was created. That is a relationship with Jesus Christ. And I want us to look at the engine room of a marriage modeled on the cross, the goal of a marriage modeled on the cross, and the fuel of a marriage modeled on the cross. The engine room is obviously Christ's love for the church and the church's submission to Christ. So submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to the husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourish and cherish it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. So marriage has always been there to model to the world the key relationship for which every one of us was created. That is a relationship with Jesus. Here is the engine room of a marriage modeled on the cross. It is Christ's love for the church and the church's submission to Christ. The word submission conjures up the wrestling ring with giant haystack stacks and marauding Madge. But nothing could actually be further from the truth. Jesus, you will remember, Luke 2, willingly submitted to his parents. So it cannot mean inequality. It is rather the image that we've been dealing with all along. It's being a helper like opposite. And the model for a woman in marriage is that of the church's submission to Christ. So then a wife is to submit to her husband using the way that the church submits to Christ as her model. So how do I submit to Jesus? Well, selflessly seeking to serve so that I can advance the cause and work in the world, I give myself to him. So wives, you need to consider your response to Jesus, and you need to mirror in your response to your husband your response to Jesus. In fact, where a woman is unable or unwilling to submit to her husband, it doesn't necessarily tell me something about the husband. It might equally tell me something about the wife. She's never learned submission. She doesn't know what it is to submit. That's the picture of verse 22. Wives, submit to your husband as to the Lord. For as the husband is the head of the wife, even so Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also the wife should submit in everything to their husband. That doesn't mean downtrodden, subservient. Jesus wasn't downtrodden and subservient. It means willingly giving yourself in service to the joint team purpose and effort that is going on as a family. And of course that will look different for all of us given the different ministries and different ministry opportunities that our families have been given by God. It'll be look different for us too given the different stages of life that we find ourselves at. So you will have to work it out differently at every stage of life along the way. I think of Janet actually saying, well, how can I redirect my ministry so that we can work better together on a couple of occasions in our married life? Some of the city wives who meet with Janet spend considerable time praying and planning how best they can support the ministry that God has given them as a couple. Even though they have to commute, the husband is commuting an hour, they're still thinking, how can we work best as a couple? And what is my part in that? Husbands, the engine is for us there at the cross, verse 25. Love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. So how is it that Christ loved us? He loved us to death, selflessly laying aside his own agenda in order to serve us. He also loved us when we were still his enemies, taking the initiative in love. He made the first step. So that I am to love Janet selflessly and to take the first step in love towards my wife. Furthermore, the love of Jesus was tangible. He acted. And one of the things I always say to a man who's finding his marriage has grown cold is not that he should look horizontally to his wife, but that he should look vertically to Christ on the cross. How did he love you? Men, I'm talking to you at the moment, so if your attention has been distracted, tune in. How did Jesus love you? He loved you tangibly. He took the initiative. He acted. And therefore, I need to ask myself, what can I do today? Even if she's wholly unresponsive, what tangible act can I plan today that is selfless and giving for her good? It will mean that Janet needs to know that she is my absolute priority. How many marriages in the city come unstuck through neglect? It's sad, isn't it, that a man who is actually seeking to provide everything for his family, sometimes the family is not blameless, they demand too much, but a man who is seeking to provide everything for his family, in seeking to provide so much for his family, actually neglects the family and contributes to the demise of the marriage. Well, there is the engine, the service and submission to Christ, and the cross, the goal. The goal is there in verses 25 to 30, and I want us to look at a couple of points very briefly. The husband's job is to sanctify, that is to make holy and to set apart your wife. So your concern is her holiness and her purity set apart in service to God. We are to love our wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. Please note that we are one unit. Paul describes the husband as head of the wife, even as Christ is head of the church, his body, and he tells us that we are to love our wives as our own body. We are one flesh, and therefore we are to consider ourselves as one unit in the service of God. My job, then, is to see Janet as set apart for the service as Christ, part of the team, part of the unit, knit to me as my arm or my leg. To neglect her or to treat her as an unessential extra is then to neglect my own self. We've been brought together as one unit in the service of God. And of course that will mean time, spending time together, praying, planning, under my leadership, working out our priorities together, considering our financial life, our family life, our ministry and service in the church, our work life. How can it all be deployed best for the service of the Lord? One unit, deploying our resources together for the work that God has given us to do in our sometimes quite different spheres. So then, women, you need to ask one another, yourself, your husband, how am I encouraging my husband to exercise this sort of leadership? How am I secretly subverting that sort of leadership? Am I? It'd be a good question to ask. Do you find that I'm actually making leadership more difficult for you? Men, we need to lead. And my experience is that many godly women are longing for us to take a lead and just wish that we would pause and say, well, shall we pray this through? Or can we have an hour to sit down and think through and work through how we can work our marriage best to the glory of God? The grace of God, marriage made in paradise, the grace of marriage marred by the fall, and the grace of marriage modeled on the kingdom, with the engine of the gospel driving marriage, with the goal, one unit, working together for the glory of God, modeling to the world the relationship of Christ and the church, and driven with its fuel, the Word of God. Well, I'm going to pause there. I want us to have 10 minutes. We started quite late. So what I'd like us to do is to take 10 minutes just to turn to our husband-wife and talk through anything that has particularly struck you as we've gone through the biblical basics. And then we'll be diving into one or two more specific areas in just a moment.